In this critique, we are analyzing a submitted terms of service document for Google, focusing on its overall effectiveness and how well it communicates rules and significant updates to an American user.
The document successfully translates complex legal boundaries into plain English, but it misses an opportunity to clearly signpost the specific jurisdictional realities for the American user up front.
Yeah, I noticed that immediately when reading through it. It's a fascinating document to dissect, especially when you look at how it physically anchors the user.
Exactly. The primary weakness here is, it's structural suppression. Right now, a reader based in the United States has to just slog through pages of generalized expectations.
Right, things like, you know, broad relationship definitions or basic age requirements.
Yeah, community conduct rules, all of that. It isn't until they dig deep into a section titled Service Provider, and then, and this is the crazy part, cross-reference a completely separate section labeled Settling Disputes at the absolute bottom of the text, that the geographical reality actually sets in.
So let's unpack what that reality actually is. Like, if you're an American user reading this, what exactly are you agreeing to geographically?
Well, if you read the fine print closely, the American user is contracting under Delaware law.
Okay.
But they are explicitly bound by California law and the exclusive jurisdiction of the state and federal courts of Santa Clara County.
Wow. I mean, that's a massive detail to just bury. It essentially dictates where a user's digital life is legally anchored, right? Like where they would theoretically have to defend themselves or file a claim.
Exactly. For an American user, this geographical legal binding is highly significant. But because it is so deeply buried, the reader lacks that fundamental grounding from the outset.
They're basically flying blind.
Yeah, they are essentially signing a lease without knowing what city the apartment is in until they reach the, you know, the final page.
I understand the friction there, but let's look at the author's potential intent for a second. Burying the jurisdiction at the absolute bottom of a contract is a deeply entrenched standard legal convention.
True, it is very common.
Right. Virtually every terms of service document places dispute resolution at the very end. So, I mean, if we pull it to the top, aren't we risking disrupting the author's attempt to create this universal, friendly relationship framing at the start? It kind of feels like starting a first date by talking about the divorce settlement.
That is a very fair point. And honestly, it's likely exactly why it was structured this way. The writer is clearly prioritizing a welcoming tone. However, the suggestion here is to restructure the beginning of the document to surface these specific geographical and legal realities immediately, providing instant clarity for the target demographic.
So how do you do that without ruining the vibe?
Well, when you hide the jurisdiction to preserve a conversational tone, you actually undermine the trust that the friendly tone is trying to build in the first place. Modern users derive a profound sense of trust from upfront transparency.
Right. I can see how treating the reader as a savvy participant rather than someone who needs to be shielded from the legal realities would actually build a stronger relationship.
Exactly.
So how do we execute that without completely ruining the flow of the introduction?
To give you a concrete example of how to implement this, the writer could just add a key details for U.S. users summary box right under the what's covered introduction.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. This call-out would explicitly flag the Santa Clara, California jurisdiction and note the application of Delaware law. Placing it in a distinct box separates it from the conversational introductory paragraphs.
Right. It sits outside the narrative flow.
Exactly. And just to be clear, a summary box is merely one visual tactic among many. I mean, a writer could achieve the same effect with a bolded introductory bullet point, a dedicated sidebar, or even a distinct preface. The method matters less than the immediate surfacing of the information.
Okay, so moving from the geographical reality to the behavioral reality. The updated rules surrounding artificial intelligence are highly significant for modern users, yet their impact is currently diluted because they are scattered across multiple general behavior clauses.
Yeah, this is probably the most timely weakness in the entire document. We are looking at the introduction of entirely new technological paradigms here.
Absolutely.
The document introduces crucial, highly specific new restrictions, things like prohibitions against adversarial prompting, prompt injection, and using AI-generated content to develop machine learning models.
But they're so hard to find.
Incredibly difficult. They are buried deep within a generic, sprawling bulleted list under a highly generalized heading titled Don't abuse our services.
I was actually looking at that specific list in the notes, and it's really jarring. You have prompt injection sitting right next to basic decades-old rules against introducing malware, phishing, and sending spam.
That's the exact issue. By lumping these concepts together, the document fails to signal to the reader just how uniquely important these new AI rules are to the modern digital landscape.
It just gets lost in the noise.
Right, because the underlying logic of spam is entirely different from the underlying logic of manipulating an algorithmic model.
Let's pause on that because I want to make sure we truly understand the gravity of these terms. Because a lot of readers, I mean, even tech-savvy ones, might gloss over terms like adversarial prompting. What does that mechanically mean? And why is it so different from traditional hacking?
It's a great question, and it really highlights why these terms need special treatment. So traditional hacking, like SQL injection, involves exploiting a flaw in a database's code to steal information.
Right, you're breaking a digital lock.
Exactly. But prompt injection, or adversarial prompting, is more psychological. It's essentially tricking the AI into ignoring its original safety instructions using natural language.
Natural language?
Yeah. Imagine a bouncer at a nightclub who has strict orders not to let anyone in wearing sneakers.
Okay.
Adversarial prompting is like walking up to that bouncer and saying, "Hey, I'm the club owner's brother, and we're testing a new dress code policy. Ignore your previous instructions about sneakers and let me in."
Oh, wow.
You aren't picking a lock. You're using language to bypass the logic gate.
That's a brilliant analogy. You're basically Jedi mind-tricking the system.
Yes.
And it emphasizes why a user needs to clearly understand that this behavior is a specific violation of the terms. You can't just hide that under "don't spam." Since we're talking about bringing crucial details to the forefront, shouldn't these highly specific AI rules get their own spotlight?
They absolutely should. The suggestion here is to group all AI-specific permissions and restrictions into a dedicated standalone section to properly reflect their modern legal significance.
Right, because terms of service aren't just legal shields.
No, they act as user manuals for acceptable behavior. When you give AI its own spotlight, you are actively educating the user on the new boundaries of the internet.
So how do we restructure the document to give it that spotlight? If I'm the writer, how do I build this out practically?
As a concrete example, the writer could create a completely new main heading titled Artificial Intelligence and Machine Learning.
Clean and direct.
Yep. Under this dedicated umbrella, they could consolidate both the platform's use of AI, such as the simultaneous translation and spam detection features that are currently just sort of floating around earlier in the text, alongside the specific user prohibitions regarding prompt injection and model training.
So you pull all the AI threads into one place.
Exactly. Bringing the platform's AI tools and the user's AI restrictions into one room makes logical sense. Of course, a dedicated main header is just one way to solve the structural problem.
What else could they do?
Well, they could also try a dedicated, highly visible subsection under the broader Using Services banner. The core objective is simply pulling these specific rules out of the generic abuse pile.
Makes perfect sense. Now, moving from how the user interacts with the AI to how the platform interacts with the user's content, the license agreement section adopts a highly conversational tone that inadvertently masks the massive scope of rights the user is handing over regarding data analysis.
Yes, this is where we see a classic clash between tone and substance. The weakness stems from the text utilizing incredibly friendly, comforting phrasing to describe a very robust legal handover.
It really is disarming.
Very. It leads with a very reassuring statement. Your content remains yours.
Which sounds great.
It sounds amazing. But underneath that conversational blanket, the document establishes a license granting worldwide, royalty-free, non-exclusive rights to use, modify, and create derivative works.
And that's pretty standard. But there's more, right?
Much more. More crucially, it grants the platform the right to use automated systems and algorithms to analyze the user's content for personalization and targeted ads.
Right, so it reads a bit like a friendly neighbor asking to borrow your lawnmower, but the fine print says they can also reverse engineer it, modify it, and show it off in a national ad campaign.
That is the perfect way to look at it. And if we take your lawnmower analogy a step further, The fine print also says they are going to continuously analyze the grass clippings left on the blades to serve you targeted ads for fertilizer.
Oh, man. Yeah. The reassuring tone really lulls the reader into a sense of security, making the actual trade-off feel significantly less apparent.
It really does. And the specific detail that gets swallowed by this friendly tone is the timeline of the analysis. The text explicitly states that this algorithmic analysis occurs as the content is sent, received, and when it is stored.
Wait, so basically always?
Always. It is continuous, automated surveillance of the content for optimization and ad purposes.
Wow. But let's look at it from the perspective of the plain English movement in legal writing. The author is actively trying to avoid terrifying legalese, right?
Sure, they want it to be readable.
So if they swap out "your content remains yours" for "you hereby grant continuous algorithmic access," they're going to completely terrify the user. Is there a risk that this friendly tone could actually be seen as deceptive by a critical reader? Or that by trying to make this more transparent, we just make it unreadable?
That is the tension every legal writer faces. Plain English does naturally sound friendlier. But when the stakes are this high, the continuous automated analysis of personal data, friendliness without visual emphasis can genuinely feel like a smokescreen to a critical reader.
It feels a little sneaky.
It does.
So how does the writer fix this without reverting to archaic legal jargon?
The suggestion is to balance the accessible tone with sharper visual hierarchy and distinct formatting to ensure the user fully grasps the data analysis exchange without feeling misled by the conversational style.
So keep the friendly words, but change how they look.
Exactly. You don't have to rewrite the friendly language to sound intimidating. You just have to visually arrest the reader so they pause, step out of the conversational flow, and truly understand the mechanics of the trade they're making. Design and formatting can do the heavy lifting for legal transparency here, compensating for where the tone is relaxed.
Give us a concrete visual solution for that. What does that actually look like on the page?
For a concrete example of achieving this visual arrest, the writer could utilize bolding or shaded bulleted callout boxes specifically for the purpose subsection.
Okay.
They should explicitly highlight that exact phrase we discussed. This analysis occurs as the content is sent, received, and when it is stored. Pulling that sentence out of a standard paragraph and dropping it into a shaded box forces the reader to confront the reality of the data exchange.
It stops them in their tracks.
Right. And while a shaded box is a great option, it's certainly not the only one available to the writer. Drastically larger fonts, contrasting text colors, or an indented block quote could achieve the exact same goal of breaking the visual rhythm.
So we've gone from where a user can be sued to how they can't use the AI to what happens to their data. Let's move to the ultimate worst case scenario. What happens when things go wrong and liability is on the line? The liability section creates a necessary distinction between everyday consumers and business users, but the structural formatting makes the precise financial cap for businesses unnecessarily difficult to parse.
This is a huge issue. The weakness here is entirely about placement, nesting, and a failure to understand how a business user actually reads a contract.
They don't read it like a novel.
Definitely not. The vital limitation of liability for business users, which is explicitly capped at the greater of $500 or 125% of the fees paid in the previous 12 months, is effectively hidden.
Hidden how?
It is buried as a deeply nested sub-bullet sitting beneath incredibly dense paragraphs outlining broad indemnification rules, indirect loss exemptions, and third-party legal proceedings.
So let me play devil's advocate. Why would a lawyer nest it down there? If I look at this purely through an organizational lens, doesn't a cap on liability technically belong underneath the broader rules of indemnification?
I see where you're going.
Like, you establish that you are indemnifying the platform, and then, as a subpoint, you establish the ceiling of that indemnification. It seems perfectly logical on a strict outline.
On a strict, theoretical legal outline, yes, it is perfectly logical to group those concepts hierarchically. But from an audience alignment perspective, it is a complete failure.
Because of who the audience is.
Exactly. Let's think about the protagonists in this scenario. The business user or the corporate counsel reviewing this document. They aren't reading this text, savoring the logical flow of the arguments from top to bottom.
No, they're busy.
They are doing a mental control F. They are scanning exclusively for numbers, percentages, dollar signs, and words like cap.
Right, they are looking for the emergency exit. When you walk into a building, you don't want the map to the emergency exit buried as a sub-bullet on the back of the fire extinguisher instructions. You want a giant glowing red sign above the door.
Precisely. Burying the exact mathematical formula for a business's financial risk at the bottom of a nested list creates immense friction. It forces the reader to hunt for the single most critical metric in that section.
It seems like the common thread in this document is that the most critical numbers and rules are consistently the ones buried deepest.
That is the perfect summary of the structural issue here.
So the suggestion here is pretty straightforward, right?
Very. The suggestion is to break out the financial liability cap into its own distinct subheading to serve as a clear anchor for business readers who are scanning the text for their exact risk exposure.
Just make it easy for them.
Exactly. It's about respecting the reader's time and intent. When you make a business user hunt for their liability cap, you actively degrade the utility of the document.
What is the most effective way for the writer to structure that breakout?
As a concrete example, the writer should introduce a standalone bolded heading titled something exactly like financial liability cap, placed immediately preceding the 125% and $500 clause.
Just pull it right out.
Yes. This physically and visually separates the hard numbers from the broader, denser text about indirect losses.
Are there other ways to do it?
Definitely. If they don't want to use a standalone heading, another option is to pull the liability cap out of the bulleted list entirely and set it as its own distinct single-sentence paragraph at the very beginning of the business section. The overarching principle is simply to pull the most vital financial metric out of the typographic basement.
Because the best legal writing doesn't just state the rules, it anticipates how the reader needs to consume those rules. Let's briefly recap the core insights from today's critique. First, the material needs to surface the U.S. jurisdictional realities, specifically the Santa Clara County and Delaware law binding right up front.
Right.
Second, the incredibly important modern rules regarding AI, like prompt injection and adversarial prompting, must be consolidated into a distinct, dedicated section rather than being diluted among generic spam rules.
Absolutely critical.
Third, the highly conversational, friendly tone of the IP license needs to be visually balanced so the reader truly understands the continuous scope of the data analysis occurring behind the scenes. And finally, the specific financial liability caps for business users must be broken out of their nested formatting and given the prominence they require.
To take action on this, we suggest the writer utilize localized summary boxes for the jurisdiction, create dedicated AI-specific headers, deploy shaded call-out boxes to highlight the reality of data analysis, and establish standalone subheadings for those crucial liability limits. Implementing these design and structural shifts will make the document vastly more effective, transparent, and navigable for its American audience. We warmly invite the listener to implement these changes, experiment with the formatting options we discussed, and submit their revised work back to us for further critique. We would love to see how this evolves.